pull up a chair. I want you to imagine flying an airplane the size of a barn at night, over enemy country, at 180 miles an hour, with your belly 60 feet off the water. Not 600 feet, not 6,000, 60 close enough, that if you sneezed and pushed the yoke you'd be swimming. That's the picture I've got in my head today. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Tail Dragger, and you're listening to The Hangar, where we spend our time with the airplanes and the people who flew them when it counted. And today we're going to talk about one of the most audacious flying jobs anybody ever strapped into. The night the Royal Air Force went after the dams of the Ruhr Valley, they called it Operation Chastise. History remembers it as the Dam Busters. Now before I get rolling, let me tell you who keeps the coffee hot around here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And friends, so does every one of these airplanes we talk about. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's set the scene. It's 1942, and Britain is looking for a way to hurt German industry in a way that actually matters. The Ruhr Valley is the beating heart of the German war machine. Steel, coal, factories running day and night, and all of that industry drinks water and runs on hydroelectric power from a handful of enormous dams. The Moni, the Eder, the Sorp. These aren't earthen berms you could kick a hole in. The Moni Dam was a wall of masonry over 100 feet thick at the base. Bombing it from altitude was hopeless. You could drop bombs on that thing all night and just chip the paint. A near miss did nothing. A direct hit did almost nothing. The problem looked impossible. Enter a quiet, stubborn engineer named Barnes Wallace.
Now here's where it gets interesting. Wallace figured out something about physics that everybody else had missed. A bomb dropped on top of a dam wastes its energy in the air and against the stone. But water. Water is nearly incompressible. If you could get a charge to explode right up against the dam wall, deep underwater, the water itself would carry that shock straight into the masonry, like putting a firecracker in your fist versus setting it in a bucket of concrete. The trick wasn't a bigger bomb. The trick was putting the bomb in exactly the right place. Snug against the wall, 30 feet down. But the Germans knew their dams were targets. They'd strung torpedo nets across the reservoirs to stop anything coming in underwater. So how do you get a bomb past the nets and pin it against the wall? Wallace's answer sounds like something a kid dreams up skipping stones on a pond, and that's exactly where he got it. He gave that bomb backspin, a big drum of a weapon spinning backward at about 500 revolutions a minute, dropped at just the right height and speed. It would skip across the surface of the water, skip, 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 right over the torpedo nets, and when it finally reached the dam wall, that backspin would grab the face of the masonry and roll the bomb down the wall, keeping it hard against the stone as it sank. 30 feet down, a hydrostatic pistol fires, and all that water does the rest. They called it upkeep. The men who had to carry it just called it the bouncing bomb. Now let me tell you about the airplane, because this is a warbird story at heart, and she deserves her due. The Avro Lancaster, four Rolls-Royce Merlin engines, a bomber with a reputation for hauling enormous loads deep into the night and bringing her crews home. If you've ever stood next to one, you know, she's huge, graceful in an ungainly sort of way. And the sound of four Merlins spooling up on a cold English evening is a sound that gets into your chest and stays there. But these Lancasters were special. They stripped them down, pulled the mid-upper gun turret, pulled armor, cut the bomb doors clean away, because upkeep was too big to fit inside. That drum hung half exposed under the belly, cradled in two arms with a little hydraulic motor to spin it up before release. This was a modified, purpose-built machine for one single mission that had never been flown by anybody ever, and they needed men to fly it. So they stood up a brand new squadron, number 617. And to lead it, they picked a 24-year-old wing commander named Guy Gibson, a veteran already, hundreds of operations behind him, and by every account a hard, demanding, absolutely fearless leader. Here's the part that gets me, as a pilot. Think about what Wallace's physics demanded of the man at the controls. For the bomb to skip right, it had to be released at exactly 60 feet above the water at exactly 232 miles an hour, and at exactly the right distance from the dam. Miss the height that the bomb shatters or skips wrong, miss the speed, same story. At night, over water, which is the hardest thing in the world to judge your height over, because it's black and flat and gives your eyes nothing to hold on to. Pilots have flown into calm water in broad daylight because they couldn't read the surface. 60 feet at night over black water. How on earth do you hold that? The answer is one of the cleverest low-tech fixes in all of aviation. They mounted two spotlights on the airplane, one in the nose, one back in the belly, angled so their two beams would cross and form a single figure eight of light on the water at precisely 60 feet. The flight engineer would look out the side, call the height,
and the pilot would fly the airplane until those two circles of light kissed together into one on the surface. When the beams merged, you were at 60 feet, not an altimeter, not a radar, two lights and a steady hand.
And for the range, the distance to release. Somebody noticed that the towers on top of the Monet Dam were a known distance apart. So they built a little wooden handheld sight, a triangle with two nails. And when the two towers lined up with the two nails, you were exactly where you needed to press the button. Skipping stones and carpenter's nails, going up against 100 feet of German masonry. They trained for weeks, low flying, and I mean low, down the valleys, over the lakes, so low that farmers looked down at them. They practiced until they could hold that airplane on the deck in their sleep. The night of May 16, 1943, 19 Lancasters lift off from Scampton in three waves and set course for the Ruhr, flying so low the whole way that they're threading between the German radar and the ground. Some of them come home early. One clips the sea and loses its bomb. One hits power lines. This is the cost of flying at treetop height in the dark across occupied Europe. It is brutal and it is unforgiving, and some of these young men are gone before they ever reach the target. Gibson gets to the Monet first. And now imagine it. The reservoir opens up in front of you, black and wide, ringed by hills. On the dam, the Germans have gun positions and they open up. Tracer coming straight at you, floating up lazy and then screaming past. And your job is to ignore all of it. Descend to 60 feet, get those two spotlight circles to merge, hold 232 miles an hour dead steady, line up the nails on the towers, and fly straight and level straight down the throat of those guns until the moment is right. Gibson makes his run and drops. The bomb skips, hits, sinks, and a column of water climbs hundreds of feet into the night. But the dam holds, so he does something extraordinary as the next crews make their runs. Gibson flies his Lancaster back and forth alongside the dam, drawing the German gunners onto himself, so they'll shoot at him instead of the man making the drop. One after another they come in. One airplane is hit and goes down, and then after the fifth bomb, the wall of the Monet Dam gives way. The crews said the water didn't so much pour as erupt. A wall of it, moving down the valley, headlights of cars on the roads below suddenly swallowed. One pilot said it looked like the whole valley was filling up with fog, and then he realized the fog was the moonlight shining on the flood. The ones with bombs left pressed on to the Eder Dam, tucked down in such steep hills that just getting lined up meant a screaming, diving turn to the deck and a hard pull to level off at 60 feet, all in a few seconds. They broke the Eder too. The Sorp, built differently, took its punishment but held. Now I'm not going to sit here and tell you it was a clean victory because it wasn't, and the men who flew it deserve the truth. Of the 19 aircraft that set out, 8 did not come back. 53 airmen were killed in a single night. That's more than half the aircrew who reached the target gone. And down in the valleys below, the flood killed well over 1,000 people, many of them prisoners and forced laborers in the camps. The Germans, for all the damage, had those dams substantially repaired by the autumn. War is like that. It rarely gives you the tidy ending the movies promise. But here's why it mattered, and why we still talk about it in hangars 80 years on. They proved something impossible was possible. A stubborn engineer with a skipping stone idea, a squadron of kids in their 20s, and a big 4 Merlin bomber flown at 60 feet in the dark, and together they cracked open a target the experts had written off. It forced the Germans to pull anti-aircraft guns and thousands of workers off other jobs to defend and rebuild every dam in the country. And it told a Britain that had been taking a beating for years that they could reach out and hit the enemy right in the machinery. And I'll tell you what stays with me. It's the airmanship. Strip away the bomb and the politics and the target, and what you've got left is pure, precise, disciplined flying at the absolute ragged edge of what a human being can do with an airplane. 60 feet. 232 miles an hour. Two circles of light on black water. Tracer coming up at you and the discipline to hold it steady anyway. That's not luck. That's training and nerve and hands that knew exactly what the airplane was doing. There's still a Lancaster or two flying in the world today, lovingly kept alive by people who understand what she represents. And if you ever get the chance to stand under those four Merlins when they light up, do it. Close your eyes and think about 19 of them, low in the dark, headed for the dams. My thanks tonight to the Royal Air Force Museum and the many historians who've kept the record of 617 Squadron straight over the years, because these men and this flight deserve to be remembered right. If you want to see photographs of upkeep and the modified Lancasters, come find us at radiohanger.com, 60 feet in the dark, straight into the guns. Next time you grumble about a little crosswind, think about that. I'm Taildragger. Keep the shiny side up.